button, and we are recording. So go ahead and do our normal preamble here. Watch your coffee, please.
What's the preamble? Is the preamble where you set the table and establish what it is that you want to do today? I understand that Brother Walden is going to bring up something, but before he brings it up, I want to just say that I'm feeling particularly Gil Scott today.
So did you share with him what happened this morning?
No, he came into my office and he said to me, love is where, no, the heart is where the
No, love hate, is love is where the hate is.
Love is where the hate is. And I had forgotten that song. And then we proceeded to listen to Esther Phillips.
Oh, my.
Sing.
So Rashid kicked this off this weekend. He goes, this or Gil Scott came first? And I was like, okay.
So then I went through this whole rabbit hole of who recorded it at the band. And the band and the producer is Creed Taylor.
Okay.
And it's a band in it's a studio in New Jersey that I happen to work mm-hmm. in. And it included on this particular Cornell Dupree, Eric Gale, David Liebman, and had an unbelievable, brass section. And the incredible thing
what
is,
what year?
1970. And we looked at it, and we looked at it going from that album to the next album that she recorded underneath that same label in 72 that Eric Gale got replaced with George Benson, and it kept on going up and up and up with bass players and horn players. Bob James replaced the guy who was playing the keyboards at the time, and it was David Sanborn was in there, and it was quite a collection of, you know, he said, is this the East Coast Wrecking Crew? I said, no, it's the New Jersey Wrecking Crew.
I'm not sure it's a wrecking crew.
Well, it was the jazz wrecking crew of New York. And as a matter of fact, they're up Route 17 of New Jersey. This was on just off of Route 17. If you went up Route 17, you wound up in Marlboro, New Jersey, and it happened to be Les Paul's studio there. And there was two clubs that were right in those neighborhoods, and they'd go back and forth playing together. But anyway, that was
so that was my gift to him this morning. I came in and just
1970. Well, that actually falls directly into my topic that I'd like to spring on you today. It started out, I was thinking that we were going to talk about albums of 1969 because it's a really bellwether year for music in 69. But one of the things, as I began looking and thinking about all the albums 69, I thought, so what happened in 68?
Right.
Which is, because what I see in 69, I'm just going to set this up and then want to talk a little bit about 68 and 69 and then 70.
Right.
Because 70 is interesting too, but 69 is most interesting to me. In 69, there's a ton of absolutely amazing albums. You know, you got Tommy, and you got Abbey Road, and you've got Captain Beefheart, and you got
two Frank Zappa albums.
Two Frank Zappa albums.
Weasels Ate Your Brain.
And you've got just a lot of what I would consider more experimental music. You also have King Crimson came out, like the birth of prog rock, if you want to, you know, give a time frame. And you get a ton of normal, what I would consider sort of central, just in a continuation, like Neil Young and Crosby, Stills, Nash. I mean, just a normal continuation. But you also get Quicksilver Messenger Service. There's not a single there, and yet it's a big album. So you start thinking about what happened between 68 and 69, where you start moving from what I would consider the sort of the end of all the 3-minute songs, every album has to have it, to a...
So there were three significant things that, because what I did in anticipation of you talking about 69, I looked at it and I said, okay, so an album of 69 probably was recorded in 68 or at least penned in sometime in 68. And some stuff that was recorded in 69 probably slipped into 70. So what I did is I did a dump of what songs and albums got produced and recorded between 68 and 70. And it is that three-year arc that actually dovetails into what we talked about last time between what happened in 67.
Right.
So in 67 could be seen as the seminal year because you had Pet Sounds, right, which spawned Sgt. Pepper's, which spawned the Rolling Stones, Her Majesty's, Request, which spawned Pink Floyd stuff, which spawned this whole series of, I'm no longer going to do this standard three-minute thing, and people started to come out with six-minute singles that the AM stations would play, but at the same time, you had the introduction of the radio format called AOR,
right.
Album-Oriented Rock, and the birth of Album-Oriented Rock combined with the albums that were getting longer, combined with the people who were no longer interested in editing down their music to be the 3 minute, or if they did, they do three or four different versions, really started to take hold. And the record company said, oh, I could actually sell this stuff. I can move product. So the business guys, who are all the guys running around the country with the singles in their trunks, you know, promoting this, said, holy crap, I can make even more money by carrying around these albums, and these kids are going to buy it. So you had that, and then you had disposable income.
Well,
and that was the other thing.
I agree with all of those things, but I want to add something that changed in 68 that became very apparent by 69. So you have Nico and the Velvet Underground and all these, what I would consider, you know, proto-punk art.
Starting
in 68.
Lou Reed
and Iggy Pop.
Max's
and then, you know,
Kansas
like, it's like
City,
all these events began happening that they were not very big hits in 68.
Well, so.
But they got their wind underneath them, but they got signed. And this is what is curious
to me, the signing part.
So let's
explore that a little bit. So here I am in New York City, 67, 68, and Max's was the place. If you want to see John Lennon, you could actually go to Max's and see John Lennon playing with Lou Reed. If you want to see Patty, you go there. If you want to go see David Bowie, you go see him. You want to go see any of these people, they were there at some point in the formative stages or the later or the evolved stages of their career, depending upon who they wanted to listen to. Not who they wanted to play with yet, who they wanted to listen to, which then influenced who they wanted to play with, who influenced who they wanted to record with. So you have guys like John Hammond showing up. You have Clive Davis showing up. You have all these New York A&R guys listening now, and you have the first AOR format station, WEDW-FM in New York City, which became this haven for people to show up and say, here's my new album, play it for me. And at 7 p.m. at night, they play the whole album. They debut the whole album, and they'd have the artist talk about the album. And you'd hear some wild, unrehearsed conversation, I'm sure, surely drug-induced in some way, shape, or form, that where people would talk, and then you'd have the secondary conversation. You have the Miles Davis showing up at the Hendrix concert. You'd have Bill Graham, who just opened the Fillmore East, and he would put these guys together.
So again, this is not news to me. This is like exactly what I've been thinking about, except I want to add about the Midwest and the West Coast. Well, I'm going to say about the Midwest. The problem with all of this is that we have new bands being signed, but there is zero internet.
Oh yeah.
So communication, like I got a new band. So who's ever heard of the Velvet Underground? You got an AOR station playing it in New York, but you got Top 40 playing in Iowa, and you got Top 40 playing in Montana, you got Top 40 playing in all these places. But the so the question becomes, you know, the importance of, and I'm going to say, the preeminence of Rolling Stone magazine in 67, 68, 69, 70 became really important for a generation.
Well, that and what was it, Cream?
Cream and Cream.
Cream that followed it. And I'm going to give credit, even though they got a lot of bad press, these, you know, trunk A&R guys who would fill up their trunk and drive from east to west with a trunk full of stop into a radio station, said, dude, hit play this. So they'd stop in Detroit, they'd stop in Chicago, they'd stop in Columbus, they'd stop in Cleveland, they'd stop in all of these, what became powerhouse AOR stations because of this sort of almost, you know, go west young man of these record guys who
I absolutely agree. This is so I think something happened in 68. Now I'm not sure exactly why it happened in 68. And we can say, you know, Monterey Pop Festival and this happened in 67, but something happened in the record industry that they said we can sign.
Clive Davis came back and convinced Columbia Records that there was a revolution or evolution about to happen, and either they were going to ride that wave and sign these artists, or they're going to miss the boat. They hired Al Kooper, Mike Broomfield, to go in and be studio session producers. They had guys on the West Coast, Lou Adler, a studio session producer. The birth of the engineer producer came into play at that moment.
68, you'd say?
Yeah, I'd say 67, 69, and then into 70, and then it changed again. But you had guys who were hearing this stuff, and they along with the musicians, wanted to experiment. They said, what can we do here? Can we, you know, the concept of Pet Sounds with animals on a soundtrack, the concept of running a microphone down a hallway 120 feet to create a sustained piano, you know, chord in that fashion. The stuff that Brian, what's his name from the, I can't believe I'm blocking the producer's name from the Beatles. But you know who I mean.
Epstein.
Not Brian Epstein, but it wasn't. What's Sir?
Martin?
George Martin. Sir George Martin. Epstein was one. But Sir George Martin, would, you know, in terms of bringing in orchestral stuff into it, and then people saying, oh. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, we were talking about this earlier. We were listening to Esther Phillips this morning, the string section on what I think was the birth of what they now know as cool jazz. I mean, because you have the emergence of Eric Gale, George Benson, Bob James, David Sanborn, all these guys who became the stalwarts, if you would, of that generation of cool jazz musicians, mixing in what they heard from the other guys with string sections and what they were hearing on the Philly sound, the TSOP. I'm going to bring in a full orchestra to Motown.
Well, then you also have the other side of it. You have the Moody Blues.
Right. There's another perfect example of two sides across the Atlantic, different sides of the Atlantic, all of a sudden recognizing that people will listen to well-produced, well-conceived, great music, even if it is a symphony orchestra.
Well, you have the nice in playing it with Keith Emerson.
Yeah.
Right.
Playing with orchestras, getting kicked out of England for...
Conquistador. You remember the song?
Conquistador, yeah. That was...
Procol Harum.
Procol Harum.
Right?
And that was...
And 68.
69 Salty Dog. So 68 maybe or 70. I'm not sure. But it's in those three-year period, certainly. But you get a lot of the association had strings as well.
Absolutely. But would you have ever heard it to the level of which you heard it? Aretha, Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman.
Yep.
Right? Even James Brown was bringing in strings.
He had to have strings. But he had horns. Horns were a big deal. So I want to say horns is something that's interesting because, as you point out, Cooper and
Michael Broomfield.
Yeah, Broomfield getting involved in Blood, Sweat, and Tears came out in 68. Chicago Transit Authority comes out in 69.
67.
No. Album came out in 69.
The album was 69.
67 in Chicago.
But yeah. Their first album,
Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Blood, Sweat, and Tears had a 69 album, too.
Yeah, they did. That was their second album.
Second album, not their first
album. First
album,
68. 68, 69. So
when was it recorded? It was actually started in 67 when they was first signed.
So I'm trying not to talk about when things are recorded because it's hard to determine when something, unless you were actually there.
Well, but this is my point. In other words, the influences. So if something came out in 68 or 67, and I'm a musician listening to, I'm going, crap, I want to do that. And then he runs back to the studio and he talks to now this, not a producer, but a producer-engineer combination. He says, how do we do that? I want to do that. I want to incorporate that kind of a feeling in, he says, into a rock song, you know, ELO, you know, that whole sort of, you know, I know you don't love ELO.
No, they're just later on.
I know, but I'm just saying that whole sort of, you know, how do you bring that to the table? Because someone else, you heard something else.
Well, so I'm going to say something else that fits into that exact thing. Is something else that happened in 68 was the White Album.
Yes.
And playing with tapes, John Lennon loved to play with tape. He just loved to play with tape. And certainly Revolution No. 9 is either a great or a terrible example to me. what your view on that song is. But that became a bellwether album for a variety of reasons, and one of them is that you could play little ditties that had nothing to do with rock at all, and they would become popular. And like it was odd because there was a great mix of really excellent songs, some really good rock songs, some very experimentally odd things, you know, and then oh-blah-dee, oh-blah-da,
mm-hmm.
You know, but anyone who knows the Beatles can probably sing that.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You were saying that, I was thinking
you
about...
You could do A Man on the Street, you know.
I was thinking about the very opening of God Bless the Child from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, where you have that sort of, you know, there's a, you know, that individual horn which builds and builds, mm-hmm. And then there's a great big drum roll, and it's got that harmonica behind it, and you know, and it's sort of like I still get chills when I hear that arrangement because the conception of taking that Billie Holiday, unbelievable classic recording, and turning it into that piece. Changed the way I listened to a lot of things.
Well, Blood, Sweat, and Tears was sort of like the perfect album for the time because it brought in blues and brass together in a way.
Super Session did for me.
Well, But they didn't have brass like
Blood, no, they didn't have brass
I'm
like
just
that.
Saying, I'm saying blues and brass came together in a way that was very remarkable. Yep. And blues were beginning to happen. You had a lot of resurgence of old blues and certainly interest in old blues. Cream came out in 67? Disraeli Gears, 67?
67, maybe the end of 66, beginning of 67.
So they were arcing, you know, at the end of 69.
Right after Blues Breakers.
And then you see Blind Faith happening in 69.
69, 70.
69 was the Blind Faith album. But it's like this interesting, so there's this whole resurgence of rock blues happening in that time that ends, I will say, with Led Zeppelin 1 being just a total Yardbirds, blues.
It's a blues ripoff.
Right. But that was 69.
One and two
came out also that year.
One and two came out, yeah.
Yeah. So, but there was something else interesting in 69, that happened that I want to throw this out and see what you have to say about it. Because two different bands came out with three albums that year, which is very interesting. You got Creedence that came out with
Bayou,
Green River, and Willie and the Poor Boys.
Okay.
That's number one. That's three albums and on each album had at least two hits.
That was the height of his prolific era.
He couldn't
write fast enough.
And the fact that a record company had the faith to release three albums from the same band in the same year.
They all sold.
Oh, no.
And I have to tell you, they were a force to be reckoned with. Both on record and live, were just like, they were that ultimate power trio, kind of, holy crap, what the hell is this?
And it was a new style of music that people hadn't really, it was sort of a...
Well, it was sort of country, but not country.
It's not bluegrass.
It's not Allman Brothers, even though you...
A little bit of Cajun thrown in there.
Yeah, but you didn't quite know who they were and where they were from, and where they were going,
and they had a lot of different sounds and different styles that sort of anyway. So that's one.
Put a spell on you. Put a spell on you. Oh my freaking God! Put a spell on you, right? Taking that song and his guitar, that guitar that he plays on that song. It's just, and it's a wailing. It is a wailing riff.
So their first album came out in 68. So they actually produced, in about 15 months, four albums, which is released.
Prolific.
Prolific and amazing. But the other band that did it, and this is sort of my point about oddly, signing bands that you're just wondering about. So Fairport Convention,
great band,
but they released three albums that year, including Legion Leaf, which is probably their best and their most famous. But three albums, you had to have a lot of faith to actually sign Fairport Convention, thinking that they were going to sell.
Right.
It's not,
because it was different.
It was so different, it's never going to be played on any radio station other than AOR. It's like, well, we've got something strange here. We ought to play this, but. Three out. You have to have faith in a band. I mean, because two. I mean, the Beatles did Yellow Submarine and Abbey Road.
Yeah, but the Beatles were already a proven commodity.
Yeah. And Led Zeppelin did one at the beginning of the year, one at the end of the year. Right. I mean, you could almost do one, 10 months apart.
Right.
Okay,
you could do it.
But three in a year is, that's like.
And they were touring. And they were touring constantly.
Right. So there's a little bit of just business acumen here. In the sense that you don't want to release albums too close together, or they'll eat each other, right?
Right.
Except they didn't.
They flew off the shelves. I'm trying to remember. Was that ATCO? Was that Atlantic Records? I think it was.
I think Atlantic was for Fairport Convention, but I don't think it was Creedence.
I wanted to take Bradley. Was it ATCO or who was it?
I'm thinking it was ATCO because I don't think it was.
I think it was the picture in my head is ATCO, but I can never pronounce the guy's name, the Lebanese gentleman who owned Ermit, whatever. But if I say it, you'll know it.
Yeah. So my point is that something changed in the I mean, you, as you point out, there, album oriented rock, a lot of extra cash. We have that. We have that. We have the boomer generation basically coming of age 25 to 30 years old. This is the, they're just hitting, you know, that time
and
frame.
And their kids are, you know, and
yeah, their kids,
such as myself, who are coming into that disposable income.
Dad, you're the tail end.
Dad gave you more than $5 or $6, you know, to you know, a week for something, right, or if you worked real hard for something like that.
Right. So that you were at the tail end of the boomer. Me too. And so I was buying albums, and which is, you know, In a God of Devita, 1968.
Hell yeah. I Am Butterfly, baby.
1969, beginning of Joe Walsh, beginning of, I mean, so many things happened in those 2 years in terms of release of albums and whatnot. But I keep on thinking.
But you just mentioned, too, I want to throw a third odd one in there. Zappa.
So
Mothers of Invention. So Zappa records two different albums under two different band names.
Right.
So you get around recording labels.
Well, he was involved
signing
with Captain Beefheart as well. So there's,
right,
there's
so
three.
So
you know,
and he was just about to start his collaborations with Clinton and stuff.
So in 69, he did Hot Rats
and
Weasels
Ate
My
Flesh
or something.
Yeah,
and
My
then,
Flesh.
And then in 68, he did he also did two albums. Mothers of Invention did We're Only in It for the Money, and
I
got to remember what Frank Zappa album he did as a separate solo career.
And then he was doing jazz projects on top of it.
Well,
that's the other thing. Everybody talks about the fact that Zappa and the Mothers and Captain Beefheart did that, but what they ignore sometimes is all the other things that he was recording and not necessarily taking recording credit for,
right,
or taking producing credit for, but he'd still show up at the sessions and still play or influence the recording and the play. So that was, you know, an interesting. So you talk about
Zappa was very productive in those years.
Fairport Convention.
Yeah.
Credence.
Yeah.
Another odd one. Zappa. Another odd one. Do we have a fourth? I'm just curious.
Of odd
people who seem to come
out of
different genre, you know, that you wouldn't go.
Well, so
how are they going to make it?
So I will say that the beginning of King Crimson launched, you know, five bands or something. You know, it's like
they had Court of the Crimson King in 69, too.
Yes, they did. Court of the Crimson King, and which, you know, Greg Lake at the time was their singer.
Right.
And you got Fripp. And you got Fripp and Greg Lake, which, you know, Fripp played with everybody. Also, the I think the biggest oddity, I'm going to say this and go right to oddity, is that was 69 was Space Oddity by David Bowie. It was the relaunch of his career because it was failing so miserably as a folk artist under the name Davy Jones. And he recreated himself as this sort of experimental odd bird with Space Oddity. And you could say that was the beginning of a whole different genre of class of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Only one album, but it was clearly an album that was remarkably different. The other thing that happened that year, which I think is odd, is the sort of the rebirth of country into mainstream. So you have Bob Dylan playing Nashville Skyline,
mm-hmm,
in 69. You have Johnny Cash with Folsom Blues.
Mm-hmm.
You got Dusty Springfield, first woman producer, winner of, like, I don't know how many Grammys that year.
Son of the Preacher Man.
Son of the Preacher Man. You get Elvis doing Live in Memphis, doing soul the whole time. I mean, and Memphis again, you got Isaac Hayes doing Hot Buttered.
Yeah, I want to separate that because that whole Isaac Hayes, Memphis soul, Memphis horn sound, I want to come back to.
What I'm getting at is that Memphis
soul, Memphis horn sound, I want to come back to.
What I'm getting at is that Memphis was all of a sudden a very, very, very hot place.
So
was all of a sudden a very, very, very hot place.
So let's go there for a second.
You got
this whole Memphis machine, which starts up with, God, what was the guy's name who starts up with? God, what was the guy's name who owned the recording studio?
For Stax Vault.
So you got Stax Vault, and they find this guy. Who's this piano player who all of a sudden has this bigger-than-life persona, and becomes Isaac Hayes' hot-blooded soul, But he was, if you look up the discography, he produced Huge Sound. But he was, if you look up the discography, he produced 40, 50 albums in like 5 years. I mean, he was literally a producing machine. And go back to this concept of a recording engineer producer with strings and horns and putting out the whole, you know, I'm going to make love to this guy on one side to I'm black and I'm proud, James Brown kind of moment.
I'm black and I'm proud, 1969.
I was
like
the way I dovetailed that in there because I did. I wanted to see if you would get that, but I'm black and I'm proud.
He released that in two separate albums, right.
There's this emergence of the Memphis soul sound, the James Brown, Georgia. You could argue New York. He was spending a lot of time in New York and in Georgia. You have Aretha, which is really, really on Atlanta Records. So you have this whole Eastern corridor of Stax Vault, Memphis horns, Muscle Shoals, here's the question. Did the introduction of horns in rock and roll influence the horns' introduction into the Stax Vault, Muscle Shoals, Philly sound of horns?
I think it would be very hard to pinpoint which came first, but I'll say...
Which came first, Berry Gordy with the Motown orchestra.
Right. So
came
what I,
first.
What I'm getting at, though, is that...
They all imitated
there's
that.
And
Frank Sinatra, Quincy Jones.
Of course.
They were imitating those two.
But the mainstream introduction of horns in a lot of different bands in 68, 69, which you can point at and say this is the beginning of, a lot of, strings and horns.
Columbia Records, I'm sorry.
Part of it is technology allowed you to do it for the first time.
Well, you could go back and do a multi-track now, and you can bring in those horn guys and have them play over that.
You had, what's the...
Hammond B3?
No, with the, Moody Blues used it a lot.
Synthesizer, Moog synthesizer.
No, it was a Mellotron, I'm thinking?
Mellotron.
You could record that on the tapes and the keys and the cartridges was put in, so you could...
It's the concept of multi-track, where you would actually take something, loop it, and then do it against it.
So exactly, but instead of looping the tape back and forth, it would be in your keyboard.
In your live mix.
So
sampling.
So 70...
Also known now as sampling, by the way.
So 70... saw the advent of the synthesizer. You saw the Moogs and the Arps show up in great quantities. In 69, they were barely there. In 68, it was Hammond B3 organs and
melody. Like,
you got a lot of organs and odd
in the big keyboards. Leslie speakers.
And big Leslie speakers. But, you know, you have that. But so there is a progression of technology that's happening in the background between 68 and 70. But I think the horns, the time it happened, I mean, I don't know what it was, it was that time. Because you see it introduced in soul, you see it introduced in rock, you see it introduced in blues. There's so many things. But it was the time of the culture,
So I think what you're pointing towards is the minute that we went from two-track and four-track machines. So in the original days, the two-track was actually a two-inch piece of tape. And then when Les Paul, God rest his soul, you know, did the first two individual machines sync together and said, and then Ampeg said, oh, we could do this. Well, we could separate that into a quarter inch and do four tracks. And then they came and they said, and it was actually, don't laugh, Mitch Miller.
Oh, Mitch Miller who
I was there. I was there in the studio where Mitch said, we're going to bring in the whole orchestra and do this, and they tried to do this the first couple of times, and they just couldn't quite sync the live performance. And so overdub, loop the track, bounce tracks. So you're familiar mm-hmm. with what a bounce yeah. track is, where you take four tracks, mix it down, bounce it to two, then lay another two on top of that, or try to sync the machines. So you've got, so at one time, I remember being there, we'd have four machines, and literally, you're physically hitting play and hitting record at the same time, so that you'd have the recordings synced next to each other, and then laying it down onto yet another four-track or a two-track piece of, you know, of tape, and do that constant sync and loop and everything else like that. But before that, it was, think about this, Sinatra, Nelson Riddle, and Quincy Jones in the Capitol Studios out in California, they would rehearse the band. And Sinatra, and I said this, remember this, because I was talking to somebody earlier today, there's only two musicians that are known for being able to arrange, sing, and conduct and change something while they performed. You know who those are? Frank Sinatra and James Brown. The only two guys that most musicians recognize can actually say, I'm going to change that right now. And Frank would do that. If you listen to the way he would delay his wording, his voicing of a song, he would change the timing of the song as they were performing.
Absolutely.
Same thing with James Brown.
Well, so this is actually, that's a big band thing,
right?
That regardless of the recording, but big bands their leader would actually conduct, where the entire band had to watch.
Right.
Because if they weren't watching, they
and
were
Frank
just playing.
So they would big bands.
They would absolutely, like, we're stopped, we're holding, now.
Right, you know, exactly. And Frank, you know, when he was...
Master of that beat, you know.
We always talk about, you know, James Brown on the one.
Yep.
And Frank. Frank was not on the one. Frank was followed the beat, and then almost in a half beat, whether it was a four measure or a three measure, he would always hold that last note and deliver it in between.
Well, that's a really jazzy thing to do.
I know, it's such a cool thing. It's such a cool thing.
He didn't release an album in 69, did he?
No. I don't think so.
I don't think that Frank did in 69. He did his live from Madison Square Garden, I think it was 1969. Actually, look it up, Bradley. He did live from Madison Square Garden with the full orchestra and Quincy Jones conducting with the Nelson Riddle Orchestra. And I think it was live on ABC, so live, yep, live to air. You know, stereo, TV, FM, simulcast, and that became a top seller. And I want to say it was like 69 or 70.
It wasn't 69.
Might have been 70.
Maybe.
It
wasn't 68. So it had to be 70 or 67. I don't think
it was 67 because they really weren't doing TV-FM simulcast at that point yet. And really 69, 70 when I got into it, doing TV-FM simulcast, that really was the beginnings of doing that kind of stuff because they didn't have the sync track capability, and Ampex came out with that sync track capability to actually do that, you know, the SMPTE time code methodology to be able to do that. That's what really drove those kind of, you know, if you would, mechanisms to be able to roll those together and do those together.
So along with everything we've talked about, I can't not talk about 69 albums. I just feel like to throw out some albums because it's a great year of albums because of everything we've talked about. There's this whole lead up to it, but 69 seems to be an explosion of excellence compared to previous years. I mean, there's just more of it.
And so The Who,
Tommy.
So who didn't record? So Janis
Jimi Hendrix did not make an album in 1969, or did not release one.
You know why?
He was probably in the hospital. I don't know.
No. He was off experimenting with Miles Davis.
Well, he released Electric Ladyland in 68, and he released
Band of Gypsies
in 70. And 69, he went to Woodstock, and he was in Europe a lot. He was in England a lot. There's a lot of things going on in 69 that he was not recording, which is interesting.
Well, there are tapes that exist of him with Miles.
Yeah. So, yeah, but not in the sense
but
of...
But not in the mainstream. Not in the mainstream.
So Janis Joplin released her first solo album.
I got them old Cosmic Blues. Again.
Again, I already
Santana.
Mentioned David Bowie. You had Santana, first album. You had Joni Mitchell's Cloud. You had Clouds. You have Neil Young's second album, which is
Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
And Crosby, Stills' first album. You have, which dovetails with, in 68, you have the last Buffalo Springfield album. And you have the Birds album in 68,
so,
and they're gone in 69. So it's like, so you have the end of an era, a bunch of eras, and then you have the sort of rebirth of them is as Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and Flying Burrito Brothers.
I was about to say Flying Burrito Brothers
because that's also out of Buffalo Springfield.
Right.
And then you have, but that whole.
What year did Delaney and Bonnie come out?
That's a good question because Cream. I mean, Eric Clapton and Cream was in those years. And so Allman Brothers came out in 69, first album.
Right,
69.
So I was about to say Allman Brothers. Don't forget Allman Brothers.
So that's an interesting, you know. And the Allman Brothers, Duane Allman, George Harrison, that's Delaney and Bonnie. And that's Delaney and Bonnie. So I would guess it would be in 70 Delaney and Bonnie happens.
Sure?
It's not 69. So it coincides because Eric Clapton and Traffic
not recorded album in 69 or released.
No, did not release. No album released.
In 68?
Blind Faith happened.
Okay, so it was already over.
Right. So Blind Faith happened in 69, which is an interesting.
10 years after?
10 years after did release Shh. And which actually.
Deep Purple.
Deep Purple, second album. First album was Shades of Deep Purple in 68.
Moody Blues
did their second album.
Had
second and third album?
They have In Search of the Lost Chord and To My Children's Children's Children.
Yeah.
So two great albums. Two, fantastic again, albums. Again, who would have thought?
Oh, they were clearly a hit from day one. But Pink Floyd had two albums as well.
Jethro Tull.
Jethro Tull had and,
Uma Guma and More. The soundtrack,
the soundtrack
to More.
Yes.
Soundtrack to More.
Jethro Tull.
They had one album. It wasn't. They hadn't really hit their stride yet. This is, I think they became 70 and 71, 72.
Airplane.
Jefferson Airplane did Volunteers, yep, which was a gargantuan hit album. They had four big releases, including Wooden Ships.
Hey, Country Joe and the Fish.
Yeah, that was there in 69.
MC5.
And the Stooges.
Absolutely. Yep. Iggy Pop.
So Iggy,
Ramones.
Nope, that's not 75.
75
was the
and
first
one. We were talking about earlier, one of my favorite albums, Soft Parade.
Soft Parade.
Soft Parade.
So, great again, album. And they, mm-hmm, they claim Soft Parade, they actually talked about it as saying that they were trying to be experimental. So this is like this is a theme to me. It's like people were absolutely trying to do something different when they've been doing pop songs. As you point out, you know, it's that sort of like,
well, it
evolution.
Was the era. It was the era where it was okay,
right,
to experiment.
And that the and what I think
because
is
everything
interesting,
was selling.
Yeah. Well, I think the other thing is that not only was everything selling, but this is the beginning of the end for a lot of the stranglehold.
So what Doors album came out in 69?
Soft Parade.
Soft Parade. Yeah.
Did only one or
only
two?
One? Only one.
So
really?
Yes had an album out.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Their first album, yes. Yeah,
exactly. That was the beginning.
And that was the beginning for
ELP?
Them.
ELP?
ELP did not. It was Nice. The Nice came out with Elegy in 69.
Only.
So, but.
What was Fripp recording at that moment?
He was recording Court of the Crimson King. So
okay,
there
you go.
So, mm-hmm, so that was the beginning of King Crimson. And.
What a great album.
Yeah, what a great album.
Well, just think about that. The Court of the Crimson, that song has
about
this
11,
incredible,
15 minutes long.
It has this great
organ
section,
yep,
that's just like, you know.
The pipe organ.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's where, you know, where the heck did that thought process even come from? You know,
well, it eventually led him to Eno, and it eventually led him to, like, he had an idea, you know?
And it's just like, oh, my God. How does... I'm speechless about that.
Boss Skaggs had an album on that.
He did. It was very... Fleetwood Mac. And so there's a lot of bands that had albums that
were
good albums.
Started. I mean, you think of some of the people that are around now. Yep.
Yes. They were playing in 69.
Yeah.
Do the Stones have any albums?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Let It Bleed came out that year, but Beggar's Bank was a bigger album than the year before.
Jay Giles Band.
Jay Giles Band did not have an album in 69.
Because they would performing seven nights a week,
right,
three shows a night.
So 70, they had two albums.
Ain't Nothing But a Party.
Alice Cooper had an album.
That was School's Out Forever, I think, wasn't it?
No, Pretty's for You.
Oh, yes. Okay. Well.
Joe Cocker, yeah.
But Sly and the Family Stone came out with Stan.
It came out with Stan.
Sly.
And with like five big monster hits off of it.
I think every one was a hit.
Yeah. No, well, there was a couple of
these. Certainly in my book, every one was a hit. And that was absolutely.
That was gold. That was just gold, gold.
So Frank Sinatra did come out with My Way.
Oh, really? Oh, my.
Yeah.
Let's do it my way.
And Dr. John, too.
Dr. John.
The Night Tripper, baby.
He actually had an album in 68 and 69, so that wasn't his first. I mean, he's actually been around a while. It's just sort of in the background.
Mac, remember Mac.
So there was somebody else. It just came and went.
Guess Who? Johnny Winter.
Guess Who?
You know, it's interesting thumbing through this list here. How many of these albums that are out now or that came out in 69 that are just, they're still
gold. Classics.
They're still classics.
You could listen to any one of those I'd say a majority of those, not anyone.
Right.
Let's not get. I won't get so super. but you could put on. The other day I was talking to my grandson, and we were talking about some things, and I put on something. He said, "What is that? That's freaking awesome!" And I know you've done the same with your boys, Bradley, yep. And you've done the same with your kids, Walden. But you know, you listen to some of that to this day, the Johnny Winter stuff. I mean,
that's totally.
I mean, he was like.
So I'll go back to Hot Buttered Soul because.
Hot Buttered Soul. Oh my God.
Had four tracks. That was it.
Each song was 14 to 16 minutes long.
You had two songs on a side, and they were long sides, so they were really long hits. But you look at the
walk
rest
on
of, like,
by,
you know.
Walk on by. The redo of the Burt Bacharach,
yep.
Diane Warwick.
But you look at that.
Who are we listening to today? The Bill Withers.
Bill Withers. Bill Withers was killing it then. Was absolutely killing it. And again, to digress for a second, the birth of what we now call cool jazz, mm-hmm. and the artists who came out, the George Benson, Eric Gales, Richard Tees, just some incredible Bob James. I mean, musicians we saw Bob James this summer, mm-hmm. still killing it.
Yeah.
Still having an incredible, 50th year of his career. I don't even know what it's at this point. It's got to be 50 years
yeah.
of his career. What about Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea.
I don't know if they produced an album in 69.
But they were playing.
Yeah, I know where they were playing with. So this is like
right. Who were they playing with? They were playing with George Duke, Stanley Clark, and
no, they weren't playing with Stanley Clark yet because that happened 2 years later.
But he was just a teenager, right. and he was playing. And who were they playing with? Frank Zappa.
Well, or John McLaughlin.
Another guy, how could we forget?
Isley Brothers came out with
an album. Isley
Did
Brothers.
They?
Oh, my God.
What album was that?
How could
it's
we,
our thing.
It's our thing. Oh,
how
my
could
goodness.
We think for, think enough remember
well,
the
you,
Isley
you just,
Brothers?
Well, you just sent me down a whole other track.
Well, there's so many great albums.
Aretha
so this,
came out in 69.
I told you, Aretha.
Well, Aretha, Lady Soul in 68 and 69 was...
You make me feel like a natural woman.
Herbie Hancock, Fat Albert Rotunda.
Oh,
I'm telling you.
The aforementioned Sly and the Family Stone, Stan, James Brown came out with,
yep.
with Dr. John, like we said earlier.
Yep. Yep.
But I want to say there was a chick album in here. John Coltrane.
Yep. Well, there's...
Esther Phillips.
There was a lot
Esther,
of...
Let me just have a moment.
Esther Phillips started our day today.
Esther Phillips and Gil Scott. Heron. Yeah,
that was,
God rest his soul. One of the guys that you'd go down to Harlem and you just sit there and he was the original rap artist. He was a member of the Young Poets. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember the group, the Young Poets. And he was the first real spoken word jazz, of the current era. They were earlier guys.
Oh, listen to I Almost Lost Detroit. It's almost a straight
Oh, my rap. God. The stuff that he would do on stage, and he just freestyle stuff, and you'd be beyond compare. Sidebar story, Friday night, and went to KUVO to their studio members concert session, and in the studio performing live was Dave Avram, 90 years old, still can play over 120 instruments, and he's freestyling and rapping songs he recorded with, ready for this, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, and Dave Brubeck, and we're sitting there, and he's doing this, and people, and I've had an opportunity to see him before, but people are like mouth open watching this 90-year-old go at it freeform freestyle. By the way, playing tonight in Denver, for those of you that unfortunately you'll
by
listen
the time
to,
you hear
to
this,
the fact, it'll be way past. But if you ever have a chance to want to see a living legend, God rest his soul, I hope he doesn't pass you, and I hope he lives for another 20 years. Dave Avram has got to be one of those seminal musicians that plays jazz, rock, classical, freeform, is on these, on the university campuses of like five different campuses as a guest professor or lecturer, holds about seven honorary doctorate degrees. This guy is unbelievable.
So I want to add a couple more names to our list because I forgot about him. Leonard Cohen came
Leonard
up with his second album.
Leonard Cohen, oh my
Bird
God.
Bird on a Wire was released in 69. His first album with Susanna was 68. So it's like you got that sort of
right.
arc happening. Laura Nyro was
Laura
her first
Nyro,
album. Was
Morning
it,
Bell Blues.
Was her first album was in was the Eli Confessions.
Eli's Coming.
The now, name of the album, something Confessions of
Confessions Eli or something like that.
And that
but
was
that's
six,
wedding,
six,
wedding
Eli's
Bell Blues.
Coming is what, Three Dog Night?
No, yeah, but,
yeah,
she,
but
wrote
she
actually
she wrote,
wrote that.
Yeah.
She so wrote that and Wedding Bell Blues, I think, she recorded she, that on the same album.
That was 68.
And that's written by Carole King.
In 69, she came out with her second album, which was equally as good, something about T-Berry or
yes.
T-Berry Street or
and
something.
Wait a second. What about albums that Carole King and James Taylor
right.
did?
So, again, I think that's 70, but in my 69, it's we're at that odd point of I'm trying
right.
to remember when it was released. So you have that sort of thing going on, which is very New York interesting, you know, folk rock. And then you have Soft Machine.
I saw that. Yeah, I have a couple of their albums at home.
Soft Machine.
In 68, they really fell apart in the beginning of 69, and Kevin Ayers, their bass player, released his first solo album, which is, I think, listed as number six on Rolling Stone's best albums of
69,
called Joy of a Toy, which is a double album, which is phenomenal, actually, but no one's ever heard of it because it's Soft Machine, and he only made a couple albums, and they didn't ever have any commercial success. It's like Donovan on Acid, which...
Donovan. Well, that's okay. Like, so what was Donovan? Was Donovan?
Donovan's over. He released
he was
his
over.
Breath, he released his best hits album
and
where, in
and
69.
Cat Stevens is 71?
Yeah, Cat Stevens
is
71.
Yeah. So it starts in 71. Like James Taylor, 71. It's like
and Lovin' Spoonful is over.
Yeah,
Lovin' Spoonful is over.
So which
Mamas
brings
and Papas
me
are basically
which
over.
Brings me to 70. I just want to say
Mama
something.
Cash was out then though.
Yeah, Mama Cash, but Mamas and Papas was over.
Yeah. So 1970, which I think is a great year for album, a great year for music, but could never ever have happened if 69. Hadn't preceded it.
You know,
it's like one of those like amazing things because people talk about how great you know the advent of 70 is in the early 70s music, but I look at 68 and 69 as the years that changed America and the world's listening.
I'm gonna argue with you for the sake of arguing that
no,
he's jumping out of character here.
That did the arc start in 65 through 67. And I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not saying I'm wrong. All I'm saying is that there were events that happened from 65 to 67 where people started doing drugs, mm-hmm. where people started to experiment, where people got tired of
the convention
doing the same conventional thing. The you know, I'm going to give credit, well-deserved credit to Brian Wilson. You know, everybody could make a joke about Brian Wilson at that point about surf music, but Brian continued to innovate and continued to create things. I mean, even the, you know, the the utilization of the surf guitar.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree that rock and jazz and blues had the seminal period. Yeah, I mean, for what becomes like mainstream later in the early 60s. But something in the water changed in 60.
They were weighted in the water. They were weighted in the water.
An explosion in a way that you didn't see it. I mean, so I look at that 68, 69 as an explosion, and maybe it was the Monterey Pop Festival and the big pop festivals that brought music to a larger audiences quickly. I'm not sure what I attribute it all to, but you know, it's as you pointed out, AOR stations. You know, the pop festival, the disposable income. There's a change in technology that absolutely changes the ability to do things, and there's also, I think, a change in the business model of the record companies to exploit all of those things and allow it to happen. You know, it's like you can't have three albums a year. That was I bet you could go into any recording studio in, let's say, 65 and say, will you allow the band to have three albums in a single year? And they would like flip out, right? And say, no, of course not. You know, two albums a year. Well, if they're the Beatles, maybe. You know,
even the Beatles had their challenges around that, and they had to push the envelope to do that. You know,
but they were allowed to. But it wasn't till later that it was became I won't say relatively common. But
here's the thing. So when you got a guy saying he's bigger than Jesus Christ, or you got a guy
more well known,
or you have, well, however you want to frame the words, you know. But certainly to the fan base, who literally couldn't sit in their seats.
Right.
I mean, they literally screamed
for an hour,
you couldn't. Nobody could hear each other. And to other things like that.
How do you feed that frenzy fast enough?
It's I hate to say it, it's almost like the opioid epidemic.
Right.
Which is if you found a drug, in this case it was music, that people will buy, except for the parents who would say, oh, no, rock and roll, it's the devil, you know, and stuff like that.
But the Beatles were actually kind of safe compared to that. I mean, they weren't shaking their hips like Elvis was. I mean, Elvis was the devil.
Well, the Beach Boys were disguised as beach music.
And they were good, too, you know, because all they were doing is talking about songs and surfing, you know, and cars. And, you know, and so they were okay.
So you're saying your premise is there's something in the water. So as you're crossing the water out to the island, what two albums you taking with you?
Oh, what two albums? From 69, what two albums would I take with me from 69? That's a hard thing. But I would probably take Court of the Crimson King, and I would probably take... Oh, I might take Blind Faith or Hot Buttered Soul.
I was going to say, which
direction am I going here?
I was going to say,
I'll give you three albums.
I'm floating with Isaac Hayes.
But then I'd have to leave off Sly, and that's four. Yeah. Now, like, give me an inch.
So it would be Court of the Crimson King.
Court of the Crimson King.
What's your next one?
Oh, I said
Hot Buttered Soul.
Hot Buttered Soul.
Sly. Every song
that's
on that album is a monster.
It is.
You know, one could argue Abbey Road.
And Abbey Road.
One could argue Abbey Road.
I might not take it with me because
here's the thing. You know, I probably would, but I know Abbey Road inside and out.
I won't need
every
to take
single.
It with me.
What?
I don't need to take it with me.
Right, I have it burned into my brain, but Hot Buttered Soul. There's some parts about that I just listen to, and it's like, so I'd probably take Core of the Crimson King and Hot Buttered Soul. I'd leave Stand because it's burned in my brain. I'd leave Abbey Road because it's burned in my brain. But those two albums. Are the gifts that keep on giving, because there's something new to be found. I don't know about about others, but I you know, so I've been buying recently remastered stuff. And in the recently remastered stuff, invariably, I said, I didn't hear that before. Yeah. I'd go back and I'd listen to it and hear a bass line or a bell or an organ line or a
It's interesting you say that because, you know, I grew up listening to a lot of different music, obviously, but being from the Detroit area, you're more towards the Motown sound. But I was listening on the way home from work the other day, listening to some Beach Boys. And I grew up listening to the Beach Boys on a transistor radio.
Right.
And then you're like going, listen to these awesome bass lines in here.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
That you never heard. So the technology definitely.
Well, I think that if you can get to hear and appreciate what was actually done, you go, holy crap.
So the bass player for Sly changed the way bass was played.
Larry Graham, yeah, absolutely.
Everywhere.
No. Absolutely.
The way he pop a bass, everyone wanted, everyone wanted to be him.
He wanted the Brothers Johnson were a direct descendant off of Larry Graham, Stanley Clark, direct descendants.
Everybody wanted to be
Bootsy Collins.
Yep.
You know, the horn players listening to Cynthia play that horn.
Yeah, I know.
You know?
So my three albums would be Soft Parade, which we talked about.
Yeah.
I love that album. It has some great memories to it. Buffalo Springfield.
They didn't come out in 69.
They didn't come out in 69.
Retrospective came out in 69.
Oh, they're best hits. Okay. I'll buy that.
Cheat. No, that's worth it.
Then I would have to throw in, you know, the Led Zeppelin. There's some Temptations in there. There's some, you know, you said Sly. There's Nashville Skyline is a great album.
Led Zeppelin, the problem is it's embroiled in my brain. I could actually probably play every single note in my brain.
The first album I like better than the second album.
Yes.
Although the second album is very...
See, my favorite album out of Zeppelin is 3.
Dun.
And I've got a really soft spot for Uma Guma because...
Yes, I do.
Because it's got the live, so it's two albums. One is the live version of Saucer Full of Secrets, and a live version of Saucer Full of Secrets is worth it. Just that
I think that was my first double album.
So what was the 69 Allman Brothers? My brain is
Whipping Post.
Whipping Post.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Come
Brothers
on,
and Sisters.
I know. Come
was,
on, it come was, on. So
but
on
Live
that
at Tillamook
album,
East was 70, and that.
Live
is that,
at Silver East is my favorite.
That's
one of my favorite
you,
live albums in the world.
So,
what did Van put out in 69?
Astral Weeks was 68.
I don't think he put
it out. So, no, exactly, right?
And that is just.
And
like,
I'm not I don't remember what he did in 69.
I think he was pissed. I think he wasn't recording because he was pissed at the record label after that.
So he might have had an off year like Jimi Hendrix where he was in between recordings.
No, he was pissed. He was pissed.
Well,
he was pissed because the record company just gave him such a hard time for that album.
Astral Weeks is it?
I know.
A monster.
It's a please. To this day, is the most classic. One of the most classic.
So another album I forgot to mention was Steppenwolf's Monster. Came out in 69.
At your birthday party, did too.
Yeah. So I mean,
the Birds, Bobby Womack.
Birds were almost over. Birds were over,
birds
actually.
Were
when
over.
Birds,
yeah.
best
birds
hits,
were over.
Best hits, maybe in 69. But they released two or three albums in 68. It's like the end of the Birds. They sort of took everything they had in the studio and just dumped them on albums.
Yeah,
it was all over.
Easy Rider came out in 69, too, right?
68.
68 or 67.
68, because Steppenwolf's first album, 68, called Steppenwolf, had Born to Be Wild and Suki Suki and the Pusher. And they also had a live cut of the Pusher in 68, which was one of the first freeform guitar solos I'd ever heard on an album. It was a full side, 27 minutes of the Pusher, where the last 3 minutes is the Pusher song, and the other
guitar
24
player. Guitar player. Come on, guitar player Bradley.
Four.
Steppenwolf.
Hold on.
Pusher Man, homework assignment, both of you.
I was sitting here
looking. Keyboard player.
I was sitting here looking at the Grand Funk came out with an album that year.
Grand Funk. Keyboard player and guitar player.
My brain's just like turned off, so I can't remember.
If Mr. Guitar can't get it, you're certainly not getting it out of me.
John McKay is the
McKay,
singer.
Right, yeah. He wasn't the singer.
And?
He was the... McKay was the organist?
I believe so.
I believe so. And then, because I'm trying to remember...
Okay, so you brought up the guitar player. I'm surprised that you don't.
Well, I'd forgotten about it because I had it on vinyl. I've never been able to see it again. It came out. It was like one of these oddball. You know, I bought it because I love the song "The Pusher," and I love Steppenwolf.
Whipping Post was '69 for Allman Brothers.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That was their first album.
But who was the guitar player on the live version of?
I have to look. I'm cheating.
The Pusher Man.
So,
okay. This for next time.
Time to sign off.
I think we're to hold this question.
And then we're going to talk about 1970 next time.
Uh-oh.
1970?
Now we're getting
we're getting slow in our years over
well,
here.
Well, these two years are...
So you realize what we've done recently.
Yeah, we've gone from 63 or 62.
No, we went from 65 to... Now we're inching to 70.
Inching to 70,
so
right?
So to tee up for that one,
uh-huh.
Difference between 69 and 70.
Well, so, I will tell you...
I mean, it's at a 10,000-foot level.
Two major things. The advent of major... piano keyboards
mm-hmm.
in 70.
Elton John.
You got Elton John, you got Yes, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Oh, yeah. And you have that sensibilities of those invading all sorts of other music.
Soul music.
And funk,
and
1970,
soul.
Funkadelic Parliament came out in 70. Both albums, 1970.
Funk and soul.
And so you see this advent of funk and soul.
And just behind the scenes... funk and soul with disco pushing right behind
right. So dance music is slowly... So what happens, I think, and I'm just going to say this, at 10,000-foot level, and you guys can crucify me for it, but you have dance music in the middle 60s.
White boy music.
White boy, but you have Dick Clark saying, can you dance to it?
Yeah,
and you got Motown. You have all this stuff going
on. Okay,
right? So you have all this danceable music... In late
but
60s, it's like all of a sudden, the psychedelic drug moves. You can't dance to like...
Okay,
you know.
So what year did Soul Train start?
It was 69.
Yeah, right,
exactly.
On the edge.
Right.
You see,
this
is what I'm saying.
So you have the edge of that just starting to pump up
over here as all of a sudden somebody said, oh... the black audience. I can make money on it. I could sell Jet Publishing. I can sell Essence hair products.
But
it's
much more than that.
And it's James Brown. What did he say? Say it loud.
Say it proud.
We're going to keep this till next week, guys. All right. Thanks.
That was fun.